Good evening, Sunday School scholars, brothers and sisters, and guests. The subject of our discussion this evening revolves around this question: where will your life be standing when Christ returns? Now, obviously, I can't tell you where your life will be standing when Christ returns any more than you can tell me where my life will be standing when Christ returns. None of us, as much as we might like, none of us have any control over the thoughts and actions of anyone else. So this is a deeply personal question which we're about to consider. Like Brother Dan earlier, I thought that Mike had given me a very simple topic. I could just say, "I don't know," and sit down. Though we can't speak of the condition of each other, there are things that we can consider at this time to try as best we can to prepare ourselves and each other against that day. So I thought that I would share with you some of the things that I was very fortunate to learn as a young man. And the first thing we need to consider is the time in which we live, the scriptural time in which we live. Perhaps one of the greatest warnings we have been given in the Bible is that we have been told that we live in a time in history which the Bible calls the Laodicean Age, or the Laodicean Stage. This is the last stage of ecclesial history. Now, Laodicean is kind of an awkward term, a funny term. So what does the word Laodicean mean? It's a term that comes from the letters to the seven ecclesias in Revelations. It was the last letter to the seven ecclesias. Laodicea was a city, a famous city from the old days. It was a beautiful city. It was designed for wealth, for sports, for relaxation, for pleasure. It was designed as a distraction from all the cares and concerns of the world. And it was named after a famous Greek queen named Laodice. Laodicea was a city for the rich. It was a city designed for people with much wealth and self-satisfaction, so that they all felt that they didn't need God. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like the age we're living in right now? When we read in Revelations, we read this about that city. We read, "And unto the angel of the ecclesia of the Laodiceans write, These things saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would that thou wert cold or hot." Now, Laodicea was a city with many wonderful spas for relaxation. And the people thought that these pools of water had healing powers. The pools were spring-fed, but they were very comfortable. Not too hot, not too cold, just sort of like a nice bath where you could sit in and go to sleep. You know, we have springs here in Lampasas, and in the old days, people used to ride the trains and the stagecoaches here to Lampasas to bathe in these sulfur springs we have. But these springs are very cold. I've jumped into these springs on a 100-degree day and like to freeze to death. But not the springs in Laodicea. They were like a nice, well-drawn bath, perfectly warm to such a pleasant temperature that you could relax and go to sleep in them. And that's what the Laodicean stage really means. It means if we let it, this world that we live in will put us to sleep. It'll make us so comfortable that we will see no reason to do anything other than relax and enjoy the circumstances we're in. Now, God tells us about this condition in Laodicea. He says, "So because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." You see, the world in which we live in today makes us think that we already have everything we need. What do we need God for? We can take care of all this stuff all by ourselves. But God's evaluation of this age is that we are not rich. We are not relaxed. We are not self-sufficient, but rather lulled to sleep, poor and blind and naked and don't even know it. Because we can't see clearly that it is from God's view how destitute of righteousness this world truly is. God's view of this world is completely different from man's. His warning to us is that if we have anything to do at all with this world, then we will let those lukewarm baths, that wealth and splendor, that pleasantness of Laodicea, put us right to sleep. Is this where we want to be when God returns? Do we want to be asleep, so relaxed, so comfortable, so self-confident that we can't really see any reason for a change being necessary? I bet every one of us, when we think about it, says no. That's not what we want. But if we don't work very hard at it, that is where we will end up. And that's the warning to our time. You know, sometimes, because of this age of wealth and convenience, I hear brothers and sisters complain that they don't really feel like they've been tested by God. And they wonder if God has a purpose for them, if they have not experienced true pain or true misery or true sorrow, true poverty. But God tells us that in living in Laodicea and not becoming part of Laodicea, that is the true trial of our age. And it may be the only trial many of us get. Can we resist the world and its luxuries without being carried away by them? Can we stay apart from it with all its pleasures and distractions and shiny trinkets? You know, it's always possible in our minds to make excuses. We can invent excuses for ourselves from now on. It'll never stop. We can even sometimes find excuses in the Bible. When we talk about how important it is to separate ourselves from the world and to keep ourselves completely separate from the world, I hear some folks refer to the Apostle Paul, who said in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9, "I wrote unto you an epistle not to company with fornicators, yet not altogether with the fornicators of the world, or with the covetous or extortioners, or with idolaters. For then ye must needs go out of the world." You see, they say, right there the apostle says we're to have company with this world. And that word translated company there, it's a big Greek word. It's sunanamignumi. Nobody's going to remember that. And it is but it's the most comprehensive word for fellowship in all the Bible. It means to be all mixed up together. So say some, we have to be mixed up with the world. Otherwise, we would have to die or leave the world somehow. But this is a horrible translation of this verse. Instead of telling us that we can be mixed up with the world, Paul was trying to tell us exactly the opposite. This should have been translated, "I wrote unto you not to mix up yourselves with fornicators, not at all with the fornicators of this world, or the covetous, or the extortioners, or the idolaters, for ye are bound from this world to come out." That is the proper understanding of how we should approach this world. We are bound from this world to come out. And that word bound means as if we were a slave. We are to slavishly avoid this world. If we have any desire to have our lives right, when Christ returns. When I was young and very much concerned with this question, wondering how you could get along within the world and not have anything to do with it, and I suppose if I was being completely honest, I'd say that I like the world. I was approaching the question more from an angle of just how close can I get to the world and still not be in it. But I had a wonderful teacher named Reem Grocott. And I asked Brother Grocott about how involved we could be with the world. And I asked him about these conflicts that we see and getting along with neighbors and with work associations and in jobs. And all these things make it hard not to be all mixed up with the world. In other words, I was asking him, how could I get my life where it needed to be at the return of Christ? And he gave me three pieces of advice that I want to share with you this evening. First, his rule was, if you can't pray about it, you probably shouldn't be doing it. If you're too embarrassed to pray about whatever it is you're doing, it probably shouldn't be done. Now, when I thought about this, it seemed to me at first to be way too general. You can't pray about every little thing of life. You can't pray about going to work and all the things that you have to do in our existence. But Brother Grocott corrected me with his second bit of advice. And he said that whatsoever is done, whatsoever has to be done, is done to God. There are no mundane little things for the believer. We have to work and earn a living and feed ourselves and eventually our families. If we have to do it as part of life, it is not mundane, but needful and necessary to be done. And anything that has to be done is done to God. And we should approach it just that way. Yes, we have to do things for our survival. But in doing this, it is done to God. And the final piece of advice that he gave, and probably not the final piece of advice that he gave me, as I probably needed a lot of straightening out, but the final piece that stuck with me is, if what you are doing cannot be done in love, even if you are right, it shouldn't be done at all. Love is the standard by which all things must be done. Now, I want to go over these things, which I found so helpful, to explain as best I can why I found them helpful. Because you see, as we sing in our hymns, life is the time to serve the Lord. Now is when we need to be getting our lives right. Remember the parable of the 10 virgins? 5 of them had prepared in advance to have enough oil in their lamps to wait for the bridegroom. 5 had not prepared. And for the 5 who had not prepared, there were no second chances. Once the bridegroom arrived, the matter was closed. You know, we read this verse in Matthew 12, 36 and 37, concerning our position at the judgment seat. We read Jesus saying, "But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned." Now, when we read this, we might think that at the judgment seat, we'll get a chance to defend our actions, sort of like in a court of law, where charges are brought and we get to argue our case on why we failed in certain instances. That is not the meaning of the judgment. We see the way the judgment works in the law of Moses and the types there. The high priest enters into the Holy of Holies, and while in there, Israel is involved in prayer. Incense, symbol of prayer, is burned continually, and that symbolizes the continuous prayers of Israel given to God in the holy, given to God, or in type, given to Jesus, directed toward Jesus, who's in the holy place. Brother Roberts explains it this way. The only other object in the holiest of all was the golden censer. That was the censer that the high priest carried in, which Aaron used on the Day of Atonement in the matter prescribed. He shall take a censer full of burning coals, charcoals-like, of fire from off the altar before the Lord, and his hand full of sweet incense, beaten small, and bring it within the veil. And he shall put the incense upon the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is upon the testimony, that he die not. Brother Roberts goes on to explain the spiritual significance between this cloud of incense that now covers everything in the holy place. He says, the spiritual significance of the incense we ascertain from Revelation 8, where John records having seen an angel with a golden censer, who took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hands. Prayer, then, is indicated by the presence of the golden censer in the holiest of all. And it is the basis that mercy is dispensed. The cloud of incense was to cover the mercy seat, that he, as Aaron, should die not. For a prayerless man, there is no mercy. That's important for us to remember. For a prayerless man, there is no mercy. Okay, so this is the picture. The high priest has entered into the holy place. This is the symbol of Christ entering into heaven. We are awaiting his return. And while he is in heaven, what is supposed to happen to that holy place? It's supposed to be filled with the incense, with our prayers. You see, when Jesus said, by your words you will be justified or condemned, he didn't mean as in a trial at his return. Our words are to be prayers made now. We are to fill heaven with them now. That when he returns, it will be as the high priest coming out of the Holy of Holies, giving us not a chance to argue our position, but an answer to the prayers which we are offering now. This is what Brother Grocott meant when he told me years ago, if you can't pray about it, you probably shouldn't be doing it. Jesus shows us this same principle in a parable. In Luke 11, we read this parable. And he said unto them, which of you shall have a friend, and shall go to him at midnight, and say to him, friend, lend me three loaves of bread, for a friend of mine in his journey has come to me, and I have nothing to set before him. And he from within shall answer and say, trouble me not, the door is now shut, and my children are with me in the bed. I cannot rise and give thee. I say unto you, though he will not rise and give it to him because he's his friend, yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him as many as he needed. And I say unto you, ask, and it shall be given unto you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened to you. For every one that asketh, receiveth. He that seeketh, findeth. And he that knocketh, it shall be opened. Note that Jesus says the man's friend doesn't get out of bed to give him loaves of bread because he's his friend. He does it because of his importunity. Because of importunity. There's a word we don't use very much. There's a word we don't use at all, probably. Kind of sounds like opportunity, doesn't it? But it doesn't mean that. It means to make repeated and continual requests, even to the point of being annoying. So here's our first clue as to how to have our lives right with Christ at his return. Have we filled heaven with our prayers? Do we pray continually? Again, Are things too small to be prayed about? That it's a problem that things are too wrong to be prayed about, and we know it. That's usually when we're embarrassed to pray about things. But as for the small things, we read this in Zechariah 4. The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, that be the temple. His hands shall also finish it, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven, and the eyes of the Lord which run to and fro throughout the earth. Here in this verse, we see a man named Zerubbabel. And this man represents or symbolizes Christ building his temple. And he tells us who shall stand when that temple is built, which of course will be when Christ returns. And it's not the ones who despise the small things. Everyone has in their mind the need and the desire to think they have to do some great thing for God. Everyone has in their minds the desire to make a great sacrifice to the Lord. Yet God is interested in those who will do the small things, the little things which He requires. You know, even in the world, there's a saying that if we take care of the small things, the big things will take care of themselves. We can look to Israel's first king to see this, King Saul. Saul was given a very simple, a very easy command. There was nothing complicated about it. It wasn't hard to understand. And with God helping him, it was a simple thing for him to accomplish. Saul was told, now go and smite Amalek. That was a tribe of people in the land. Go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not. But slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Amalek was a tribe of people that had warred against the children of Israel, interfering with them on their march coming out of Egypt. And God had determined that it was time for these disobedient folks to go. And God gave the task of getting rid of them to Saul. So Saul went. But he didn't mind or pay attention to the small things. He defeated Amalek with God's help. But he kept the spoil to himself, directly against the simple command that he'd been given. We are told this of Saul. And he took Agag and the Amalekites alive and utterly destroyed all, or the king of the Amalekites alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good and would not utterly destroy them. But everything that was vile and refuse, that they utterly destroyed. In other words, Saul got rid of all the bad stuff, all the stuff he didn't want anyway. But he kept the good stuff to himself. And Samuel the prophet went to Saul and asked him, why he had not minded the small things. Why he had not obeyed the commandment of God. And note Saul's answer. For it's an answer that continues to live in the sons of men today. And Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God. And the rest we have utterly destroyed. You see, Saul decided that the little things didn't matter. Obedience didn't matter. Saul thought he had a better idea. Let's take the best of the land and make this great sacrifice to God. Saul had decided that his idea to do great things, to make a great sacrifice to the Lord, were more important than God's ideas of minding the little things and giving God complete and unwavering obedience. How did that work out for Saul? How will it work out for us at Christ's return if we decide those are the same things we should do? Ignore being obedient to God's commands and try and make a great display or great sacrifice. This is what Samuel told Saul. And Samuel said, "Hath the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to hearken, that is to listen, is better than the fat of rams." To obey, that is, to do the little things that God has commanded to be done, are far more important than any great and splendid sacrifice that any man can imagine. Now think about this for a minute. When we disobey God, what we're really doing is we're telling God that we have a better idea. We know better than God how to serve him. Saul wanted to give God a great and wonderful gift. But what man can give anything to God that he doesn't already have? God says the cattle upon 1,000 hills are his. All of creation belongs to God. The only gift we can truly give God is our dedication, our obedience, and our love. That's the only thing which he doesn't already have. And that's what he requires of us at the return of Christ. If we wonder where our life will be standing at Christ's return, consider Saul. So where was his life after he became king and had all his wealth and splendor, sort of like we do in this Laodicean age? He was no longer focused on God. Saul became so self-satisfied that he lost his ability to do the small things. He felt he had to do great things. And Samuel tells him, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, he also hath rejected thee from being king." Do we want to know where we will stand at Christ's return? Measure it not by the things which we do, by how splendid are our churches, or how great are our missionary programs and our outreach programs and our food pantries and all these things. These are the things that the churches around us all do and how they measure their lives. And they regard the few of us as poor and pitiful, just a little group that can't accomplish any of the great works that they see themselves doing. They have long since ceased to pay attention to the small things. This reminds me of a young Christadelphian Sunday school scholar raised here in Central Texas, a man who didn't get this. This man couldn't understand the necessity of humble obedience as opposed to the pomp and the circumstances of the giant churches. I once read a story of this man taking a hunting trip with some other friends of his, and while they were in their cabin talking, they began to talk about their various churches. And they were complaining about them mostly, as they recognized the changes that were taking place in their churches, becoming more and more worldly and less religious than even before. And we know the truth of this as we see the churches around us accept all manner of abominations under the sun and think that they're okay. Well, this former Sunday school scholar listened to them complain about the breaking down of their churches and then spoke up and said, "I was raised the furthest thing from religion that there is. I was raised a Christadelphian." You see, his idea of religion was that of a great display. He was like Saul, wanting to make a great sacrifice to God, inventing ideas in his own mind how best to worship God. He completely missed the point that to obey is better than to sacrifice, and to do little things is better than all the sacrifices that could be done, and that it was truly all that matters. The humble farmers here in Central Texas, speaking on the true and simple things of the Bible, made no impression on him. The flowing robes and the huge churches and listening to those men that the world calls doctors in divinity, is what made him think he was doing something righteous and noble. This former Christadelphian Sunday School scholar went on to become the President of the United States. But to what purpose? Jesus asked, "For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" President Lyndon Johnson did gain the whole world. He became, in his generation, the most powerful man in the world, but completely lost sight of all the small things. And what part of his worldly greatness can he give for his soul? Now, the final thing, and the most important thing we should think about as we consider where our lives are to be at Christ's return, is this. Jesus said, "If ye love me, keep my commandments." As we read in introducing this discussion this evening, the writings in 1 Corinthians 13, and we saw there the word charity, and we saw how it meant everything. And that word charity should have been translated love. The love of God and Christ is first and foremost in all things. But the kind of love we're talking about is not that emotional, natural love common to friends and family, but rather a love which must be learned. The love of the world is natural, and the world rewards those who love her. And that makes this matter doubly difficult. To love God is to love the righteousness and justness of God. To love the things that God stands for is to despise the things of the world. It is something we need to be conscious of and work towards. The Apostle John once wrote to an ecclesia in 2 John. He says, "And now I beseech thee, lady," and to beseech is to request earnestly, to really petition, to really make the point, "not as though I wrote a new commandment unto thee, but that which we had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk after his commandments. This is the commandment, that as ye heard from the beginning, ye should walk in it." You see, we have to be commanded to love. It's not at first natural. It's learned. And we have to constantly strive to learn to love the principles of the things of God to the point where we come to despise this world. There are specific reasons why God has set his plan in motion. And the most specific of all is because disobedience leads to death, leads to absolute tragedy. To rejoice or find humor in wickedness is to find pleasure in unrighteousness, even if we don't participate in it. And this was what was meant when it was said this afternoon, we must have our heart in it. Or as Jesus said, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Or as Brother Grocott once told some friends of mine when they were playing a Bible game and one of them didn't know the answer to a scriptural question and made an excuse for it, Brother Grocott said, quite frankly, "If it was important to you, you would know it." We know the things that are important to us, don't we? Is the Bible important to us? Do we know it? Are we interested in learning it, making it part of our heart, making it our treasure? And we must keep in mind that being right is simply not enough. If we are right but taking pleasure in correcting one another, it is all done wrong, all done for the wrong reasons, and all for nothing. All things must be done in love or not at all. In closing our discussion, I might add one more suggestion as to how to have your life in order when Christ returns. There are always things that are going on around us, always things that are concerning our time and our thoughts and are apt to get our perspective out of order in their matter of importance. Problems relating to friends and to family and to jobs can at times seem overwhelming. and the love of God gets pushed onto the back burners. Anytime this happens, we need to stop and ask ourselves of the things which are so occupying our time and seem so important at the specific time we're living. We need to ask ourselves, how important will this be really the day after Christ returns? All these things that seem overwhelming, the day after Christ returns, will never give them a second thought. When we keep that question in mind, all things will always fall back into their proper place. So I know that this evening I have not answered your question. I can't tell you where your lives will be at Christ's return, and it's just something we all control and have to all work at with great diligence every day of our life. But I hope some of these thoughts, which I've had to consider in the past, will have been a help, that at Christ's return, we might be a family together, united in the love of Christ at his return.